Hannah at 35. Ruth couldn't sleep. The cause of her insomnia was the cognac, in combination with what she had confessed to Eddie O'Hare, which was something she'd not told even Hannah Grant. At every important passage in her life, Ruth had anticipated that she would hear from her mother. Upon her graduation from Exeter, for example, it didn't happen. And there came and went her graduation from Middlebury without a word. Nevertheless, Ruth had gone on expecting to hear from Marion, especially in 1980 upon the publication of her first novel. And there were then the publications of two more novels, the second in 85 and the third right now in the fall of 1990. That was why, when the presumptuous Mrs. Benton had attempted to pass herself off as Ruth's mother, Ruth had been so vulnerable. For years, she'd imagined that Marion might suddenly announce herself in exactly that way. "Do you think she ever will make an appearance?" Ruth had asked Eddie in the taxi. Eddie had disappointed her. In the course of her thrilling evening with him, Eddie had done much to contradict Ruth's first unfair impression of him, but in the taxi he'd fumbled badly. He began. "I imagine that your mother must make peace with herself before she can, re-enter your life." Eddie paused, as if he hoped that the taxi had already arrived at the Stanhope. He said again, "Marion has her demons, her ghosts, I suppose, and she must somehow try to deal with them before she can make herself available to you." "She's my mother, for Christ's sake!" Ruth had cried in the cab. "I'm the demon she should be trying to deal with." But all that Eddie had managed to say was, "I almost forgot there was a book, actually two books, that I wanted to give you." Here she'd asked him the most important question in her life. Was it reasonable for her to hope that her mother would ever contact her? And Eddie had pawed around in his wet briefcase, producing two water-damaged books. One of them was the inscribed copy of his Litany of Sexual Bliss to Marion 60 times, and the other? Naturally, he'd been at a loss to say what the other book was. He'd simply thrust it into her lap in the taxi. "You said you were going to Europe," Eddie told her. "This is good airplane reading." At such a time, and in answer to Ruth's all-important question, he'd offered her airplane reading. Then the taxi had stopped at the Stanhope. Eddie had given Ruth the clumsiest of handshakes. She'd kissed him, of course, and he'd blushed, like a 16-year-old boy. "We must get together when you're back from Europe," Eddie had called from the departing cab. Maybe he was bad at goodbyes. In all honesty, pathetic and unfortunate did not do him justice. He'd made an art form of his modesty. He wore his self-deprecation like a badge of honor, Ruth wrote in her diary. And there was nothing of the weasel about him. Ruth had heard her father call Eddie a weasel on more than one occasion. Also, when it was still early in their evening together, Ruth had understood something about Eddie. He never complained. In addition to his prettiness, his frail-looking beauty, what her mother might have seen in him was something that extended beyond his loyalty to her. Despite his appearance to the contrary, Eddie O'Hare was remarkably brave. He had accepted Marion as she was. And in the summer of 58, Ruth imagined, her mother had not necessarily been at her psychological best. Half naked, Ruth went looking through her suite at the Stanhope for the alleged airplane reading that Eddie had given her. She was too drunk to waste a word of The Life of Graham Greene, and she had already read 60 times. In truth, she'd read it twice. To her dismay, the airplane reading appeared to be some kind of crime fiction. Ruth was immediately put off by the title, Followed Home from the Flying Food Circus. Both the author and the publisher were unknown to her. Upon closer inspection, Ruth saw that the publisher was Canadian. Even the author photo was a mystery, for the woman, the unknown writer was a woman, was in profile to the camera, and what little could be seen of her face was backlit. The woman also wore a hat which shaded the only eye that was exposed to the camera. All that could be seen of her face was a fine nose, a strong chin, a sharp cheekbone. Her hair, what of it that fell free of the hat, might have been blonde or gray or almost white. Her age was indeterminable. It was an exasperating photograph, and Ruth was not surprised to read that the unknown author's name was a nom de plume. A woman who hid her face would choose a pen name. So this was what Eddie called airplane reading. Even before she began the book, Ruth was unimpressed. And the beginning of the novel was not much better than Ruth's initial judgment of the book by its cover. Ruth read. A sales girl, who was also a waitress, had been found dead in her apartment on Jarvis, south of Girard. It was an apartment within her means, but only because she had shared it with two other sales girls. The three of them sold bras at Eaton's. A detective novel? Ruth snapped the book shut. Where was there a Jarvis Street or a Girard? What was Eaton's? What did Ruth Cole care about girls who sold bras? She'd finally fallen asleep, it was after 2, when the telephone woke her. "Are you alone? Can you talk?" Hannah asked her in a whisper. "Definitely alone," Ruth said, "but why would I want to talk to you, you traitor?" "I knew you'd be angry," Hannah said. "I almost didn't call." "Is that an apology?" Ruth asked her best friend. She had never heard Hannah apologize. "Something came up," Hannah whispered. "Something or someone?" Ruth asked. "Same difference," Hannah replied. "I was suddenly called out of town." "Why are you whispering?" Ruth asked her. "I'd rather not wake him up," Hannah said. "You mean you're with someone now?" Ruth asked. "Is he there?" "Not exactly," Hannah whispered. "I had to move to another bedroom because he snores. I never imagined that he would snore." "It must be a big house," Ruth commented. "Pretty big," Hannah replied. Hannah never failed to mention some intimacy involving her sexual partners, yet she could also be coy about them. "I was disappointed that you weren't with me," Ruth told her. But even as she spoke, it occurred to Ruth that if Hannah had been there, Hannah would never have let Ruth be alone with Eddie. Hannah would have been too curious about Eddie. She would have wanted Eddie all to herself. "On second thought," Ruth told her friend, "I'm glad you weren't with me. I got to be alone with Eddie O'Hare." "So you still haven't done it with Alan," Hannah whispered. "The main thing about this evening was Eddie," Ruth replied. "I never saw my mother as clearly as I can see her now." "But when are you gonna do it with Alan?" Hannah asked. "When I get back from Europe, probably," Ruth said. "Don't you want to hear about my mother?" "When you get back from Europe?" Hannah whispered. "That's what, in 2 or 3 weeks? God, he might meet someone else before you get back. And what about you? Even you might meet someone else." "If either Alan or I meet someone else," Ruth replied, "then it will be an especially good thing that we haven't slept together." It wasn't until she put it that way that Ruth feared she cared more about losing Alan as an editor than about losing him as a husband. "So tell me everything about Eddie O'Hare," Hannah whispered. "He's very sweet," Ruth began. "He's quite odd, but mainly sweet."
"But is he sexy?" Hannah asked. "I mean, could you imagine him with your mother? Your mother was so beautiful."
"Eddie O'Hare is a little beautiful," Ruth replied.
"Do you mean he's effeminate?" Hannah asked. "My God, he's not gay, is he?"
"No, no, he's not gay. He's not effeminate either," Ruth told Hannah. "He's just very gentle, surprisingly delicate-looking."
"I thought he was tall," Hannah said.
"Tall and delicate," Ruth replied.
"I can't see it. He sounds odd," Hannah said.
"I said he was odd," Ruth told her. "Odd and sweet and delicate, and he's devoted to my mother. I mean, he would marry her tomorrow."
He would?
Hannah whispered.
But how old would your mother be? 70-something?
71, Ruth said, and Eddie is only 48.
That is odd, Hannah whispered.
Don't you want to hear about my mother? Ruth repeated.
Just a minute, Hannah told her.
She went away from the phone. Then she was back.
I thought he said something, but it was just more snoring.
I can tell you another time if you're not interested, Ruth said coldly. It was almost her reading aloud voice.
Of course I'm interested, Hannah whispered.
I suppose you and Eddie talked about your dead brothers. We talked about the photographs of my dead brothers, Ruth told her.
I should hope so, Hannah answered.
It was strange because there were some that he remembered that I didn't. And there were others that I remembered, but he didn't. We agreed that we must have invented these particular photographs. Then there were others that we both remembered, and we thought that these must be the real ones. I think we each had more invented photographs than we had real ones.
You and what's real and what's invented, Hannah remarked. Your favorite subject.
Ruth resented Hannah's obvious lack of interest, but she went on. The photo of Thomas playing doctor to Timothy's knee, that one is definitely real, Ruth said. And the one where Thomas is taller than my mother and he's holding a hockey puck in his teeth, we both remember that one too.
I remember the one of your mother in bed, with your brother's feet, Hannah said.
It was hardly surprising that Hannah would remember that one. Ruth had taken it to Exeter with her, and to Middlebury, too. Presently, it was in the bedroom of her house in Vermont. Eddie had not told Ruth that he'd masturbated to this particular picture of Marion after he'd hidden the feet. When Ruth had raised the memory of those feet being covered with what looked like little pieces of paper, Eddie had told her that he didn't remember anything covering the feet. "Then I must have invented that, too," Ruth had said.
"And I remember the one of your brothers at Exeter under the good old come hither boys and be men bullshit," Hannah said. "God, they were good-looking guys."
Ruth had shown Hannah that photo of her brothers the first time Hannah had come home with her to Sagaponack. They'd been at Middlebury at the time. The photo was always in her father's bedroom, and Ruth had brought Hannah into his bedroom when her father was playing squash in his devious barn. Hannah had said the same thing then, that they were good-looking guys. That would be what Hannah would remember, Ruth thought. Eddie and I remembered the featured photograph in the kitchen, the one of both boys eating lobster, Ruth went on. Thomas is dismantling his lobster with the ease and dispassion of a scientist. There's not the slightest strain on his face, whereas it's as if Timothy is fighting his lobster and the lobster's winning. I think that's the picture I remember best. And all these years I wondered if I invented it or if it was real. Eddie said it was the one he remembered best, so it must be real.
Didn't you ever ask your father about the photographs?
Hannah asked. Surely he would remember them better than you or Eddie.
He was so angry at my mother for taking them with her that he refused to talk about them, Ruth answered. You're too hard on him, Hannah told her. I think he's charming.
I've seen him be charming a few too many times, Ruth told Hannah. Besides, all he ever is charming, especially when he's around you. Uncharacteristically, Hannah let Ruth's remark pass. It was Hannah's theory that many women who had known Marion, even if only by a photograph, must have been flattered by Ted Cole's attentions to them simply because of how beautiful Marion had been. Ruth's response to Hannah's theory was, "I'm sure that must have made my mother feel terrific." Now Ruth felt frankly tired of trying to explain the importance of her evening with Eddie to Hannah. Hannah just wasn't getting it.
"But what did Eddie say about the sex, or did he say anything about it?" Hannah asked.
It's absolutely all she's interested in, Ruth thought. Ruth despaired of talking about sex because that subject would soon lead Hannah back to her questions regarding when Ruth was going to do it with Alan. "That photograph you remember so surprisingly well," Ruth began. "My good-looking brother's in the doorway of the main academy building."
"What about it?" Hannah asked.
"Eddie told me that my mother made love to him under that photograph," Ruth reported. "It was the first time they did it. My mother left the photo for Eddie, but my father took it."
"And he hung it in his bedroom," Hannah whispered harshly. "That's interesting."
"What a remarkable memory you have, Hannah," Ruth said. "You even remember that the photograph of my brother's is in my father's bedroom." But Hannah made no response, and Ruth thought again. "I'm tired of this conversation." She was most of all tired of Hannah never saying she was sorry. Ruth sometimes wondered if Hannah would still be her friend if Ruth hadn't become famous. In her own way, in the smaller world of magazines, Hannah was famous, too. She'd first made a name for herself writing personal essays. She'd kept a comedic diary. For the most part, it was a journal of her sexual exploits. But she'd soon tired of autobiography. Hannah had graduated to death and devastation. In her morbid phase, Hannah had interviewed people who were dying of AIDS. She'd also talked to terminal cancer patients. Terminal children had captured her attention for about 18 months. Later, there'd been a piece on a burn ward and one on a leper colony, too. She'd traveled to war zones and to countries with widespread famine. Then Hannah had graduated once again. She'd left death and devastation for the world of the perverse and the bizarre. She once wrote about a male porn star who was reputed to have a perpetual hard-on. His name in the business was Mr. Metal. Hannah had also interviewed a Belgian woman in her 70s who'd performed in over 3,000 live sex shows. Her only partner had been her husband, who died following a sex performance. The grieving widow had not had sex since. Not only had she been faithful to her husband for 40 years, for the last 20 years of their marriage, they'd had sex only in front of an audience. Now Hannah had transformed herself yet again. Her current interest was in famous people, which in the United States meant mainly movie stars and sports heroes, and the occasional eccentric who was disturbingly rich. Hannah had never interviewed a writer, although she'd raised the subject of an extensive, or had Hannah said exhaustive, interview with Ruth. Ruth had long believed that the only interesting thing about her was her writing. She was deeply leery of the idea of Hannah interviewing her because Hannah was more interested in Ruth's personal life than she was in Ruth's novels. And what did interest Hannah in Ruth's writing was what was personal, what Hannah would have called real about it. "Hannah will probably hate Alan," Ruth suddenly thought. Alan had already admitted that Ruth's fame was, if not a burden, a nuisance to him. He had edited a number of famous authors, but he would submit to an interview only on the grounds that his remarks were not for attribution. Alan was so private that he didn't even permit his writers to dedicate their books to him. When one writer had insisted, Alan said, "Only if you use my initials, just my initials." Thus the book was dedicated to AFA. It struck Ruth as disloyal that she couldn't recall what the F stood for.
"I gotta go. I think I hear him," Hannah was whispering.
"You're not going to stand me up in Sagaponack, are you?" Ruth asked. "I'm counting on you to save me from my father."
"I'll be there. I'll get myself there somehow," Hannah whispered. "I think it's your father who needs saving from you, the poor man."
Since when had her father become the poor man? But Ruth was tired. She let Hannah's remark pass. After she'd hung up the phone, Ruth reconsidered her plans. Since she was not seeing Alan for dinner, she could leave for Sagaponack after her last interview, a day earlier than she'd planned. Then she would have one night alone with her father. One night alone with him might be tolerable. Hannah would arrive the next day, and they would have a night together, just the three of them. Ruth couldn't wait to tell her father how much she had liked Eddie O'Hare, not to mention some of the things that Eddie had told her about her mother. It would be best if Hannah was not there when Ruth told her father that her mother had thought of leaving him before the boys had been killed. Ruth didn't want Hannah around for that conversation, because Hannah always stood up for Ruth's father, maybe just to provoke her. Ruth was still so irritated with Hannah that she had some difficulty falling back to sleep. Lying awake, she found herself remembering the time she lost her virginity. It was impossible for her to recall the event without considering Hannah's contribution to the minor disaster. Although she was a year younger than Ruth, Hannah had always seemed older, not only because Hannah had had 3 abortions before Ruth managed to lose her virginity, but also because Hannah's greater sexual experience lent her an air of maturity and sophistication. Even at Exeter, Ruth had been 16, Hannah 15 when they'd met, Hannah had demonstrated greater sexual confidence. And this was before Hannah had had sex. In her diary, Ruth once wrote of Hannah, "She projected an aura of worldliness long before she'd been in the world." Hannah's parents, who were happily married, she called them boring and staid, had brought up their only child in a fine old house on Brattle Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hannah's father, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, had a patrician demeanor. His deportment bespoke a steadfast inclination to remain uninvolved, which Hannah said suited a man who'd married a wealthy and utterly unambitious woman. Ruth had always liked Hannah's mother, who was good-natured and gracious to the point of being utterly benign. She also read a great deal. One truly never saw her without a book. Mrs. Grant had once told Ruth that she'd had only one child because after Hannah was born, she missed all the time she'd once had to read. Hannah told Ruth that her mother couldn't wait for Hannah to be old enough to amuse herself so that Mrs. Grant could get back to her books. And amuse herself, Hannah did. Perhaps it was her mother who'd made Hannah the superficial and impatient reader that she was. While Ruth thought Hannah was fortunate to have a father who was faithful to his wife, Hannah said that a little womanizing might have made her father less predictable. To Hannah, less predictable meant more interesting. She claimed that her father's remoteness was the result of his years in the law school, where his abstract ruminations on the theoretical levels of the law appeared to have distanced him from any appreciation of the practice of law itself. He had a great disdain for lawyers. Professor Grant had urged the study of foreign languages on his daughter. His highest hope for Hannah was for her to pursue a career in international banking. In his opinion, international banking had been where the best and the brightest of his students at Harvard Law School had ended up. Her father had a great disdain for journalists, too. Hannah was at Middlebury, where she'd majored in French and German, when she decided that journalism was the career for her. She'd known this with the same certainty that Ruth had known, at an earlier age, that she wanted to be a novelist. Hannah had announced, with a most matter-of-fact surety, that she would go to New York and make her way in the world of magazines. To that end, she asked her parents to send her to Europe for a year upon her graduation from college. There she could practice her French and her German, and she would keep a journal. Her powers of observation, as Hannah put it, would be honed. Ruth, who'd applied and been accepted to the graduate program in creative writing at the University of Iowa, had been caught off guard by Hannah's suggestion that Ruth come to Europe with her. "If you're going to be a writer, you need something to write about," Hannah had told her friend. Ruth already knew that it didn't work that way, at least not for her. She needed only time to write. As for what she would write about, it already awaited her in her imagination. But she deferred her acceptance to Iowa. After all, her father could afford it, and a year in Europe with Hannah would be fun. "Besides," Hannah told her, "it's high time you got laid. If you stick with me, it's bound to happen." It had not happened in London, the first city on their tour, but Ruth was groped by a boy in the pub of the Royal Court Hotel. She'd met him at the National Portrait Gallery, where Ruth had gone to see the portraits of several of her favorite writers. The young man took her to the theater and to an expensive Italian restaurant off Sloane Square. He was an American who lived in London. His father was a diplomat of some kind. He was the first boy she'd gone out with who'd had credit cards, although Ruth suspected that the cards belonged to his father. They'd got drunk in the pub of the Royal Court instead of getting laid, because Hannah was already using Ruth and Hannah's room at the Royal Court by the time Ruth got up the nerve to bring the young man to her hotel. Hannah was noisily making love to a Lebanese she'd picked up in a bank. She'd met him when she was cashing a traveler's check. "My first experience in the field of international banking," she'd written in her journal. "My father would finally have been proud of me." The second city on their European tour was Stockholm. Contrary to Hannah's prediction, not all Swedes were blonde. The two young men who picked up Hannah and Ruth were dark-haired and handsome. They were still in university, yet they were very sure of themselves, and one of them, the one who ended up with Ruth, spoke excellent English. The slightly better-looking one, who spoke hardly a word of English, had immediately latched on to Hannah. Ruth's designated young man drove the four of them to his parents' house, which was 3/4 of an hour from Stockholm. His parents were away for the weekend. It was a modern house with lots of light-colored wood. Ruth's young man, whose name was Per, poached a salmon with some dill, which they ate with new potatoes and a salad of watercress and hard-boiled eggs with chive. Hannah and Ruth drank 2 bottles of white wine, while the boys drank beer, and then the slightly better-looking boy took Hannah off to one of the guest bedrooms. It was not the first time that Ruth had overheard Hannah making love, but it was somehow different, knowing that the young man with Hannah couldn't speak English. And because the entire time that Hannah was grunting away, Ruth and Per were washing the dishes. Per kept saying, "I'm awfully glad your friend is having such a grand time." And Ruth kept saying, "Hannah always has a grand time." Ruth wished there were more dishes to wash, but she knew she had stalled long enough. Finally, she said, "I'm a virgin." "Do you still want to be?" Per asked her. "No, but I'm very nervous," she warned him. She also thrust a condom at him before he had even begun to take off his clothes. Hannah's 3 pregnancies had taught Ruth a thing or two, albeit belatedly. They had even taught a thing or two to Hannah. Ruth and Hannah were always stuffing each other's purses and coat pockets with condoms. When Ruth thrust one at Per, the young Swede looked surprised. "Are you sure you're a virgin?" he asked her. "I've never been with a virgin." Per was nearly as nervous as Ruth was, which Ruth appreciated. He'd also had too much beer, which he remarked on mid-coitus. "Ul," he said in her ear, which Ruth mistook as an announcement that he was coming. On the contrary, he was apologizing for why it was taking him so long to come. "Ul" is Swedish for beer. But Ruth had no experience to compare him to. Their lovemaking was neither too long nor too short for her. Her principal motivation was to have the experience behind her, to simply, at last, have done it. She felt nothing. So, thinking it proper sex etiquette in Sweden, Ruth said, "Earl, too," although she wasn't coming. When Per withdrew from her, he seemed disappointed that there was not more blood. He'd expected a virgin to bleed a lot. Ruth assumed this meant that the whole experience had been less than he'd expected. It was definitely less than she'd expected. Less fun, less passion, even less pain. It had all been less. It made it hard to imagine what Hannah Grant had been so fiercely grunting about for all these years. But what Ruth Cole learned from her very first experience in Sweden was that the consequences of sex are often more memorable than the act itself. For Hannah, There were no consequences that she considered worth remembering. Not even her 3 abortions had deterred her from repeating and repeating the act, which she apparently found to be of far greater importance than whatever its consequences were. But on the morning when Per's parents returned home, greatly ahead of schedule, Ruth was alone and naked in Per's parents' bed. Per was taking a shower when his mother walked into her bedroom and began speaking Swedish to Ruth. In addition to not understanding the woman, Ruth could not find her clothes. Nor could Per hear his mother's sharply rising voice over the sound of his shower. Then Per's father walked into the bedroom. While Per may have been disappointed in how little Ruth had bled, Ruth saw that she had bled on the towel she'd spread on the bed. She had conscientiously taken pains in advance not to stain Per's parents' sheets. Now, as she hastily tried to cover herself with the blood-stained towel, she was aware that Per's mother and father had seen all of her and her blood. Per's father, a dour-looking man, was speechless. Yet his staring at Ruth was as unremitting as his wife's mounting hysteria. It was Hannah who helped Ruth find her clothes. Hannah also had the presence of mind to open the bathroom door and yell at Per to get out of the shower. "Tell your mother to stop shouting at my friend," Hannah had yelled at him. Then she'd yelled at Per's mother, too. "Shout at your son, not at her, you dumb cunt." But Per's mother could not stop herself from shouting at Ruth, and Per was too cowardly, or too easily convinced that he and Ruth were in the wrong, to oppose his mother. As for Ruth, she was as incapable of decisive movement as she was of coherent speech. She mutely let Hannah dress her, like a child. "Poor baby," Hannah said to her. "What lousy luck for your first time. It usually ends up better than this." "The sex was okay," Ruth mumbled. "Just okay?" Hannah asked her. "Did you hear that, you limp dick?" Hannah shouted at Per. "She says you were just okay." Then Hannah noticed that Per's father was still staring at Ruth, and she shouted at him. "Hey, you fuckface," she called him. "Do you get off on gawking or what?" "Shall I call you and your companion a cab?" Per's father asked Hannah, in English even better than his son's. "If you can understand me," Hannah said to him, "tell your abusive bitch of a wife to stop shouting at my friend. Tell her to shout at your jerk-off son instead." "Young lady," Per's father said, "my words have had no discernible effect on my wife for years." Ruth would remember the elder Swede's stately sadness better than she would ever remember the craven Per. And when Per's father had stared at her nakedness, it was not lust that Ruth saw in his eyes, only his crippling envy of his lucky son. In the taxi riding back to Stockholm, Hannah had asked Ruth, "Wasn't Hamlet's father a Swede? And his bitch of a mother, too, and the bad uncle, I suppose, not to mention the dumb girl who drowns herself. Weren't they all Swedes?" "No, they were Danes," Ruth replied. She took a grim satisfaction from the fact that she was still bleeding, if only a little. "Swedes, Danes, same difference," Hannah said. "They're all assholes." Later, Hannah had announced, "I'm sorry your sex was just okay. Mine was terrific. He had the biggest schlong I've ever seen so far," she added. "I didn't look at Per's," Ruth had admitted. "Was I supposed to?" "Poor baby. Don't worry," Hannah had told her. "Remember to look at it the next time. Anyway, it's how it feels that matters." "It felt okay, I guess," Ruth had said. "It just wasn't what I expected." "Did you expect worse or better?" Hannah had asked her. "I think I expected worse and better," Ruth had replied. "That'll happen," Hannah had told her. "You can count on it. You'll definitely have worse and better." At least Hannah had been right about that. At last, Ruth fell back to sleep. Ted, at 77. He didn't look a day over 57, of course. It was not merely a matter of the squash keeping him fit, although it troubled Ruth that her father's trim, compact body, which was the prototype of her own body, had established itself in her mind's eye as the model of the male form. Ted had kept himself small. In addition to Alan Albright's habit of eating off other people's plates, there was the problem of Alan's size. He was much taller and a little heavier than the men Ruth generally preferred. But Ruth's theory, in regard to how her father had failed to age, was entirely separate from her father's physical fitness or his size. Ted's forehead was unlined. There were no pouches under his eyes. Ruth's crow's feet were almost as pronounced as his. The skin of her father's face was so smooth and clean that it might have been the face of a boy who'd only begun to shave, or who needed to shave only twice a week. Since Marion had left him, and, retching squid ink into a toilet, he'd sworn off hard liquor, he drank only beer and wine, Ted slept as soundly as a child. And however much he'd suffered from the loss of his sons, and later from losing their photographs, he appeared to have put his suffering to rest. Maybe the man's most infuriating gift was how soundly and for how long he could sleep. In Ruth's view, her father was a man without a conscience or the usual anxieties. He felt no stress. As Marion had observed, Ted did almost nothing. As an author and illustrator of children's books, he had already succeeded, as long ago as 1942, in excess of his small ambitions. He hadn't written anything in years, but he didn't have to. Ruth wondered if he had ever really wanted to. The mouse crawling between the walls, the door in the floor, a sound like someone trying not to make a sound, there wasn't a bookstore anywhere in the world with a decent children's section that didn't carry Ted Cole's backlist. There were video cassettes, too. Ted had provided the drawings for the animation. About all Ted did now was draw. And if his celebrity status had dimmed in the Hamptons, Ted was in demand elsewhere. Every summer he seduced at least one mother at a fair-weather writers' conference in California, and another at a conference in Colorado, and another in Vermont. He was also popular on college campuses, especially at state universities in out-of-the-way states. With occasional exceptions, today's college students were too young to be seduced by even as ageless a man as Ted was, but the neglected loneliness among faculty wives whose children had grown up and left home was unabated. Those women were still younger women to Ted. Between the writers' conferences and the college campuses, it was surprising that in 32 years, Ted Cole had never crossed paths with Eddie O'Hare. But Eddie had taken pains to avoid such an encounter. For him, it was merely a matter of inquiring who comprised the guest faculty and the visiting lecturers. Whenever Eddie had heard Ted's name, he declined the invitation. And if her crow's feet were any indication, Ruth despaired that she was showing her age more than her father showed his. Worse, she was deeply concerned that her father's low opinion of marriage might have made a lasting impression on her. On the occasion of her 30th birthday, which she'd celebrated with her father and Hannah in New York, Ruth had made an uncharacteristically light-hearted remark on the subject of her few and fast-failing relationships with men. "Well, Daddy," she'd said to him, "you probably thought I'd be married by now and that you could stop worrying about me." "No, Ruthie," he'd told her, "it's when you are married that I'll start worrying about you." "Yeah, why get married?" Hannah had said. "You can have all the guys you want." "All men are basically unfaithful, Ruthie," her father had said. He'd already told her that, even before she went to Exeter, when she'd been 15. But he found a way to repeat it, at least semi-annually. "However, if I want a child," Ruth had said. She knew Hannah's opinion of having a child. Hannah didn't want one. And Ruth was well aware of her father's point of view that to have a child was to live in constant fear that something would happen to your child, Now, to mention the evidence that Ruth's mother had, in her father's words, failed the mother test. "Do you want to have a child, Ruthie?" her father had asked her.
"I don't know," Ruth had admitted.
"There's a lot of time to stay single then," Hannah had told her. But now she was 36. If Ruth wanted a child, there was not a lot of time left. And when she'd merely mentioned Alan Albright to her father, Ted Cole had said, "What is he, 12, 15 years older than you are, isn't he?" Because her father knew everything about everyone in publishing. Ted may have stopped writing, but he kept up with the business of writing. "Alan is 18 years older than I am, Daddy," Ruth had acknowledged. "But he's like you. He's very healthy."
"I don't care how healthy he is," Ted had said. "If he's 18 years older than you are, he's going to die on you, Ruthie. And what if he leaves you with a young child to raise all by yourself?"
The specter of raising a young child by herself had haunted her. She knew how lucky both she and her father had been. Conchita Gomez had virtually raised Ruth. But Eduardo and Conchita were her father's age, the difference being that they looked it. If Ruth didn't have a baby sometime soon, Conchita would be too old to help her raise it. And how could Conchita help Ruth raise a baby anyway? The Gomezes still worked for her father. As usual, when it came to the subject of marriage and children, Ruth had put the cart before the horse. She was jumping ahead to the question of having a child before she'd answered the question of who, or if, to marry. And Ruth had no one she could talk to about this except Alan. Her best friend didn't want a child. Hannah was Hannah. And her father was, well, her father. Now, even more than when she'd been a child, Ruth wanted to talk to her mother. "Damn her anyway," Ruth thought. Ruth had long ago resolved that she would not go looking for her mother. Marion was the one who'd left. Either Marion would come back, or she wouldn't. And what sort of man had no male friends, Ruth reflected. She'd once put the accusation to her father directly.
"I have male friends," her father had protested.
"Name two, name just one," Ruth had challenged him. To her surprise, he'd named four. They were unfamiliar names to her. He'd boldly listed his current squash opponents. Their names changed every few years because Ted's opponents invariably grew too old to keep up with him. His present opponents were Eddie's age or younger. Ruth had met the youngest of them. Her father had the swimming pool he'd always wanted and the outdoor shower, much as he'd described his image of them to Eduardo and Eddie in the summer of 58, on the morning after Marion had left. There were two showers in a single wooden stall, side by side, locker room style, Ted called it. Ruth had grown up watching naked men and her naked father running out of the outdoor shower and jumping into the pool. As sexually inexperienced as she was, Ruth had seen a lot of penises. It was perhaps this image of unknown men showering and swimming naked with her father that had caused Ruth to dispute Hannah's assumption that bigger was necessarily better. It had been late last summer or early last fall when she'd met her father's youngest squash opponent of the moment, a lawyer in his late 30s, Scott somebody. She'd come out on the deck of the swimming pool to dry her beach towel and her swimming suit on the line, and there were her father and his young opponent in their après-squash or après-shower nakedness.
"Ruthie, this is Scott, my daughter Ruth,"
Ted had started to say, but Scott saw her and dove in the pool.
"He's a lawyer," her father had added, while Scott was still underwater.
Then Scott somebody had surfaced in the deep end where he began to tread water. He was a strawberry blonde and built like her father. He had a medium-sized schlong, she thought.
"Nice to meet you, Ruth," the young lawyer had said.
He had short, curly hair and freckles. "Nice to meet you, Scott," Ruth had replied, going back inside the house. Her father, still standing naked on the deck, had remarked to Scott,
"I can't decide whether to go in or not. Is it cold? It was quite cold yesterday."
"It's pretty cold," Ruth had heard Scott say,
But it's okay once you're in. And these ever-changing squash opponents were what passed for Ted's only male friends. Nor were her father's opponents very good squash players. Her father didn't like to lose. His most frequent opponents were good athletes who were relatively new to the game. In the winter months, Ted found a lot of tennis players who wanted the exercise. They had a feeling for racket sports, but squash strokes are not tennis strokes. Squash is a game you play with your wrist. In the summer, when the tennis players would return to their tennis, they would discover that their game had deteriorated. You can't play tennis with your wrist. Then Ted might have a convert to squash on his hands. Her father chose his squash opponents as selfishly and with as great a degree of calculation as he chose his lovers. Maybe they were his only friends. Was her father invited to their homes for dinner? Did he hit on their wives? Did her father have any rules? Ruth wanted to know. She was standing on the south side of 41st Street, between Lexington and 3rd, waiting for the jitney that would take her to the Hamptons. Once she arrived in Bridgehampton, she would call her father to pick her up. Ruth had already tried to call him, but her father was out, or not answering the phone, and he'd left his answering machine off. Ruth had a lot of luggage, all the clothes she would need in Europe. She was thinking that she should have called Eduardo or Conchita Gomez. If they weren't doing something for her father or actually working at her father's house, the Gomezes were always home. Thus her mind was beset with the trivia of last-minute travel when her father's youngest squash opponent approached her on the sidewalk of 41st Street. "Going home?" Scott, somebody asked her. "You're Ruth Cole, aren't you?" Ruth was used to being recognized. At first she mistook him for one of her readers. Then she noted his boyish freckles and his short, curly hair. She'd not known many strawberry blondes. Besides, he was carrying nothing but a slim briefcase and a gym bag. Two squash rackets protruded from the half-open zipper of the bag. "Oh, it's the swimmer," Ruth said. It was strangely satisfying to see him blush. It was a warm, sunny Indian summer day. Scott Somebody had removed his suit jacket and looped it through the shoulder strap of his gym bag. His tie was loosened, and the sleeves of his white shirt were rolled up above his elbows. Ruth was aware of the greater size and muscularity of his left forearm, even as he held his right hand out to her. "It's Scott. Scott Saunders," he reminded her, shaking her hand. "You're left-handed, aren't you?" Ruth asked him. She didn't like to play left-handers. Her best serve was to the left-hand court. A lefty could return that serve with his forehand. "Got your racket with you?" Scott Saunders asked her, after admitting he was left-handed. He noticed all her luggage. "I've got 3 rackets with me," Ruth replied. "They're packed." "Staying with your dad for a while?" the lawyer asked. "Only 2 nights," Ruth said. "Then I'm going to Europe." "Oh," Scott said. "Business?" "Translations, yes." She already knew they were going to sit together on the bus. Maybe he had a car parked in Bridgehampton, then he could drive her and all her luggage to Sacaponic. Maybe his wife was meeting him and they wouldn't mind dropping her off. In the pool, his wedding ring had reflected the late afternoon sunlight as he'd treaded water, but when they were seated beside each other on the jitney, his wedding ring was gone. Among Ruth's rules for relationships, one of the inviolable ones was this: no married men. There was the shattering sound of an airplane overhead. The bus was passing LaGuardia. When Ruth said, "Let me guess, my father has converted you from tennis to squash. And with your complexion, you're very fair, you must burn easily. Squash is better for your skin anyway. It keeps you out of the sun." He had a wicked, secretive sort of smile. It suggested his suspicion that nearly everything could lead to litigation. Scott Saunders was not a nice guy. Ruth felt pretty sure of that. "Actually," he began, "I gave up tennis for squash when I got divorced. As part of the settlement, my ex-wife got to keep the country club membership. It meant a lot to her," he added, generously. "And besides, there were the children's swimming lessons. How old are your children? Ruth asked him dutifully. Hannah had told her long ago that it was the first question you should ask a guy who's divorced.
It makes divorced men feel like good fathers to talk about their kids, Hannah had said.
And if you're going to get involved with a guy, you want to know if it's a 3-year-old or a teenager you might have to deal with. It makes a difference.
As the jitney moved eastward, Ruth had already forgotten the ages of Scott Saunders' children. She was more interested in how his squash game compared to her father's.
Oh, he usually wins, the lawyer admitted. After he wins the first 3 or 4 games, he sometimes lets me win 1 or 2.
You play that many games? Ruth asked. 5 or 6?
We play for at least an hour, often an hour and a half, Scott said. We don't really count the number of games.
You wouldn't last an hour and a half with me, Ruth decided. The old man must be slipping.
But all she said was, you must like to run.
I'm in pretty good shape, Scott Saunders said.
He looked in very good shape, but Ruth let his remark pass. She gazed out the window, knowing that he was taking this moment to evaluate her breasts. She could see his reflection in the bus window.
Your father says you're a very good player, better than most men, the lawyer added. But he says he's still better than you for a few more years.
He's wrong, Ruth said. He's not better than I am. He's just smart enough to never play me on a court of regulation size, and he knows his barn. He never plays me anywhere else.
There's probably something psychological about his advantage, the lawyer said.
I'll beat him, Ruth said. Then maybe I'll stop playing.
Maybe we could play sometime, Scott Saunders said. My kids are only around on the weekends. Today is Tuesday.
You don't work Tuesdays? Ruth asked. She watched the bright flicker in his smile again, like a secret he wanted you to know existed but which he would never tell.
I'm enjoying divorce leave, he told her. I take as much time out of the office as I need.
Do they really call it divorce leave? Ruth asked.
That's what I call it, the lawyer said. When it comes to the office, I'm pretty independent.
He said it in the way he'd said he was in pretty good shape. It could mean that he'd just been fired or that he was some killer lawyer with uncounted successes.
Here I go again, Ruth knew. She considered that the wrong guys always attracted her because they were so transparently short-term.
Maybe we could play a little round robin, Scott suggested. You know, the 3 of us. You play your father plays me, then I play you.
I don't play round robin, Ruth said. I just play one-on-one for a long time. About 2 hours, she added, purposely staring out the window, so he was left looking at her breasts.
2 hours, he repeated.
Just kidding, she told him. Turning to face him, she smiled.
Oh, Scott Saunders said.
Maybe we could play tomorrow, just the 2 of us.
I want to beat my father first, Ruth said.
She knew that Alan Albright was the next person she should sleep with, but it troubled her that she'd needed to remind herself of Alan and of what she should do. Historically, Scott Saunders was more her kind of guy.
The strawberry blonde lawyer had parked his car near the Little League field in Bridgehampton. He and Ruth, burdened by her luggage, had to walk about 200 yards. Scott drove with the windows open. As they turned onto Parsonage Lane in Sagaponack, they were driving due east with the elongated shadow of the car running ahead of them. To the south, the slanting light turned the potato fields a jade green color. The ocean, offset against the faded blue of the sky, was as brilliant and as deep a blue as a sapphire. For everything that was overesteemed and corrupted about the Hamptons, the end of an early fall day could still be dazzling. Ruth permitted herself to feel that the place was redeemed, if only at this time of year and at this forgiving hour of the late afternoon. Her father would have just finished his squash. He and his defeated opponent might now be showering or swimming naked in the pool. The towering horseshoe-shaped barrier of privet, which Eduardo had planted in the fall of 1958, completely shaded the pool from the late afternoon light. The hedges were so thick, only the thinnest rays of the sun could penetrate. These small diamonds of light dappled the dark water of the pool like phosphorescence, or gold coins that floated on the surface instead of sinking. And the wooden deck overhung the water. When someone was swimming in the pool, the water sounded like the water of a lake, slapping against the dock. When they arrived at the house, Scott helped Ruth carry her bags into the front hall. The navy blue Volvo, which was her father's only car, was in the driveway, but her father didn't answer when Ruth called. "Daddy?" As he was leaving, Scott said, "He's probably in the pool. It's that time of day." "Yes," Ruth said. "Thank you," she called after him. "Oh, Alan, save me," she thought. Ruth was hoping she'd never see Scott Saunders or another man like him again. She had three bags, a big suitcase, a garment bag, and a smaller suitcase that was her carry-on bag for the plane. She started by carrying the garment bag and the smaller suitcase upstairs. Some years ago, when she was 9 or 10, she'd moved her room from the nursery that shared her father's master bathroom to the biggest and farthest away of the bedrooms in the guest wing. It was the room that Eddie O'Hare had occupied in the summer of 58. Ruth liked it because of its distance from her father's room and because it had its own bathroom. The door to the master bedroom was ajar, but her father wasn't in his bedroom. Ruth called, "Daddy," again as she passed the slightly open door. As always, the photographs in the guest wing hall commanded her attention. All the bare picture hooks, which she remembered better than the photos of her dead brothers, were covered now. There were hundreds of uninspired photographs of Ruth at every phase of her childhood and throughout her young womanhood. Sometimes her father was in the photo, but usually he was the photographer. Frequently, Conchita Gomez was in the picture with Ruth. And there were the endless privet pictures. These measured her growth summer by summer. Ruth and Eduardo solemnly posed before the implacable privet. No matter how much Ruth grew, the unstoppable hedge grew faster until, one day, it had more than doubled Eduardo's height. In several of the photographs, Eduardo looked a little afraid of the privet. And, of course, there were some recent photographs of Ruth with Hannah. Ruth was walking barefoot down the carpeted stairs when she heard the splashing from the swimming pool, which was behind the house. She couldn't see the pool from the staircase or from any of the bedrooms upstairs. All the bedrooms faced south. They were designed to have an ocean view. Ruth hadn't noticed another car in the driveway, only her father's navy blue Volvo. But she assumed that his present squash opponent lived near enough to have ridden a bicycle. She wouldn't have noticed a bicycle. The degree to which Scott Saunders had tempted her left Ruth feeling familiarly unsure of herself. She didn't want to see another man today, although she seriously doubted that any of her father's other squash opponents could possibly have attracted her as strongly as the strawberry blonde lawyer. In the front hall, she got a good grip on her remaining suitcase, the big one, and started upstairs with it, purposely avoiding that view of the swimming pool which was available to her as she passed the dining room. The sound of splashing followed her only halfway up the stairs. By the time she unpacked, the guy, whoever he was, would be gone. But Ruth was a veteran traveler. It took her very little time to unpack. When she'd finished, she'd put on her swimsuit. After her father's squash opponent was gone, Ruth thought she would jump in the pool. That always felt good after being in the city. Then she would see about dinner. She would make her daddy a good dinner. Then they would talk. She was still barefoot, padding down the upstairs hall, past the partially open door to her father's bedroom, when a sea breeze blew the door shut. Thinking she would find a book or a shoe, something to hold the door ajar, Ruth opened the door to the master bedroom. The first shoe that caught her eye was a woman's high-heeled shoe, of a beautiful salmon pink color. Ruth picked it up. It was very good leather. The shoe had been made in Milan. Ruth saw that the bed was unmade,
A small black bra lay on top of the tangled sheets. So, her father was not in the pool with one of his squash opponents. Ruth took a closer, more critical look at the bra. It was a push-up bra, an expensive one. It would have been utterly gratuitous for Ruth to wear a push-up bra, but the woman in the pool with her father must have thought she needed one. The woman had small breasts. The bra was a 32B, Hannah's size. That was when Ruth recognized the open suitcase on the floor of her father's bedroom. It was a well-worn, brown leather suitcase, distinguished by its much-traveled appearance and by its practical compartments and its useful, efficient straps. It had been Hannah's carry-on bag for as long as Ruth had known Hannah. The bag made Hannah look like a journalist before she was a journalist, Ruth had written in her diary. She couldn't remember how many years ago. Ruth stood as still in her father's bedroom as she would have stood if Hannah and her father had been naked in bed in front of her. The sea breeze blew through the bedroom window again. It blew shut the door behind her. Ruth felt as if she'd been locked in a closet. If something had brushed against her, a dress on a hanger, she would have fainted or screamed. She struggled to summon that state of calm in which she composed her novels. Ruth thought of a novel as a great untidy house, a disorderly mansion. Her job was to make the place fit to live in, to give it at least the semblance of order. Only when she wrote was she unafraid. When Ruth was afraid, she had difficulty breathing. Fear paralyzed her. As a child, the sudden proximity of a spider would freeze her on the spot. Once, behind a closed door, an unseen dog had barked at her. She'd not been able to remove her hand from the doorknob. Now the thought of Hannah with her father took her breath away. Ruth had to make an enormous effort just to move. At first, she moved very slowly. She folded the small black bra and put it in Hannah's open suitcase. She found Hannah's other shoe, it was under the bed, and she put the pair of salmon pink shoes alongside the suitcase where they could not be missed. In what Ruth knew would be the haste of things to come, she wanted Hannah not to leave any of her sexy little items behind. Before Ruth left her father's bedroom, she looked at the photograph of her dead brothers in the doorway of the main academy building. She considered that Hannah's memory was not as remarkable as she'd supposed when she'd talked to Hannah on the phone. So, Hannah stood me up because she was fucking my father, Ruth thought. She walked into the guest wing hall, taking off her swimsuit as she went. She looked in the two smaller guest bedrooms. Both beds were made, but one was dented with the shape of a slender body, and the pillows were bunched up against the headboard of the bed. The phone, normally on the night table, sat on the side of the bed. It had been from this guest bedroom that Hannah had phoned her, whispering, so as not to wake Ruth's father after she had fucked him. Ruth was naked now. She trailed the swimsuit behind her as she continued down the guest wing hall to her room. There she dressed herself in more characteristic clothes, jeans, one of the good bras Hannah had bought for her, a black T-shirt. For what she was about to do, she wanted to be in her uniform. Then Ruth went downstairs into the kitchen. Hannah, a lazy cook but an adequate one, was planning to stir-fry some vegetables. She'd cut up a red and a yellow pepper and had tossed them in a bowl with some broccoli florets. The vegetables were sweating slightly. Ruth tasted one of the pieces of the yellow pepper. Hannah had sprinkled the vegetables with salt and sugar to make them bleed a little. Ruth recalled showing Hannah how to do that. It had been one of the weekends they'd spent together at Ruth's house in Vermont, complaining about bad boyfriends, as Ruth now remembered it. Hannah had also peeled a ginger root and mashed it. She'd set out the wok and the peanut oil, too.
Ruth looked in the fridge and saw the shrimp marinating in a bowl. She was familiar with the dinner Hannah was preparing. Ruth had made this same dinner for Hannah, and for various boyfriends, many times. The only thing that wasn't ready to cook was the rice. There were two bottles of white wine on the door of the fridge. Ruth took one out, opened it, and poured herself a glass. She walked into the dining room and out the screen door onto the terrace. When Hannah and her father heard the door close, they quickly swam away from each other, but both of them ended up in the deep end of the pool. They'd been squatting together in the shallow end, or else Ruth's father had been squatting while Hannah bobbed in the water in his lap. Now, in the deep end, their heads were small against the sparkling field of blue. Hannah looked less blonde than usual. Her wet hair was dark. Ruth's father's hair was dark, too. His thick, wavy hair had turned a metallic shade of gray, generously streaked with white. But in the dark blue pool, Ted's wet hair was almost black. Hannah's head seemed as sleek as her body. "She looks like a rat," Ruth thought. And Hannah's small breasts bounced as she treaded water. The image that came to Ruth's mind was that Hannah's little tits looked like darting, one-eyed fish. "I got out here early," Hannah began, but Ruth cut her off. "You were here last night. You called me after you fucked my father." "I could have told you that he snored," Ruth said.
"Ruthie, don't," her father said.
"You're the one who has a problem with fucking, baby,"
Hannah told her.
"Hannah, don't," Ted said.
"Most civilized countries have laws," Ruth told them. "Most societies have rules."
"I've heard this," Hannah called to her.
Hannah's tiny face looked less confident than usual, but maybe it was only because Hannah wasn't a strong swimmer. Treading water didn't come naturally to her.
"Most families have rules, Daddy," Ruth told her father. "Most friends, too," Ruth said to Hannah. "Okay, okay, I'm lawlessness personified," Hannah told her friend.
"You never apologize, do you?" Ruth asked her.
"Okay, I'm sorry," Hannah said. "Does that make it better?"
"It was an accident. It was nothing planned," Ted told his daughter.
"That must have been a novelty for you, Daddy," Ruth said.
"We ran into each other in the city," Hannah began. "I saw him standing on the corner of 5th and 59th by the Sherry Netherland. He was waiting for the light to change."
"I'm sure I don't need to know the details," Ruth told them. "You're always so superior," Hannah cried. Then she started coughing. "I've got to get out of this fucking pool before I drown."
"You can get out of my house, too," Ruth told her. "Just get your things and go."
There was no ladder in Ted Cole's pool. Ladders were not aesthetically pleasing to Ted. Hannah had to swim to the shallow end and walk up the steps near Ruth.
"Since when is it your house?" Hannah said. "I thought it was your father's."
"Hannah, don't," Ted said again.
"I want you to get out of here too, Daddy," Ruth told her father. "I want to be alone. I came home to be with you and with my best friend," she added. "But now I want you both gone."
"I'm still your best friend, for Christ's sake," Hannah said to Ruth.
She was wrapping herself in a towel, the scrawny little rat, Ruth thought.
"And I'm still your father, Ruthie. Nothing's changed," Ted said.
"What's changed is that I don't want to see you. I don't want to sleep in the same house with either of you," Ruth said.
"Ruthie, Ruthie," her father said.
"I told you she's a fucking princess, a prima donna," Hannah told Ted. "First you spoiled her, now the whole world is spoiling her."
So they had talked about her, too, Ruth thought.
"Hannah, don't,"
Ruth's father said, but Hannah walked into the house, letting the screen door slam. Ted kept treading water in the deep end of the pool. He could tread water all day.
"I had a lot to talk to you about, Daddy," she told him.
"We can still talk, Ruthie. Nothing's changed," he repeated.
Ruth had finished her wine. She looked at her empty glass. Then she threw it at her father's bobbing head. She missed him by a safe margin. The wine glass plunked into the water and sank, unbroken and dancing like a ballet slipper, to the bottom of the deep end of the pool.
I want to be alone, Ruth told her father again. You wanted to fuck Hannah, now you can leave with her. Go on, just go with Hannah.
I'm sorry, Ruthie, her father said. But Ruth went into the house, leaving him to tread water.
Ruth stood in the kitchen. Her knees shook a little when she washed the rice and let it drain in a sieve. She was sure she'd lost her appetite. To her relief, her father and Hannah didn't try to talk to her again. Ruth heard Hannah's high-heeled shoes in the front hall. She could imagine how perfect those salmon-pink shoes looked on a slinky blonde. Then she heard the navy-blue Volvo, its wide tires crushing the stones in the driveway. In the summer of 58, the driveway of the Coles' house in Sagaponack had been a dirt driveway, but Eduardo Gomez had convinced Ted to try crushed stones. Eduardo had got the idea for a driveway of crushed stones from the infamous driveway at Mrs. Vaughn's. Ruth stood in the kitchen, listening to the Volvo moving west on Parsonage Lane. Maybe her father would take Hannah back to New York. Maybe they would stay in Hannah's apartment. They should be too embarrassed to spend another night together, Ruth thought. But her father, although he could be sheepish, was never embarrassed, and Hannah wasn't even sorry. They would probably go to the American Hotel in Sag Harbor, and they would call later, both of them, but at different times. Ruth remembered that her father's answering machine was off. She resolved that she would not answer the phone. But when the phone rang, only an hour later, Ruth thought it might be Alan. She answered it.
"I'm still thinking about playing squash with you," Scott Saunders said.
"I'm not in the mood for squash," Ruth lied. There was a golden quality to his skin, she remembered. His freckles were the color of a beach.
"If I can steal you away from your father," Scott said, "how about dinner tomorrow night?"
Ruth had not been able to cook the dinner that Hannah had largely prepared. She knew she couldn't eat. "I'm sorry, I'm not in the mood for dinner," Ruth told the lawyer.
"Maybe you'll change your mind tomorrow," Scott said.
Ruth could imagine his smile, the self-importance of it.
"Maybe," Ruth confessed to him.
Somehow she found the strength to hang up the phone. She wouldn't answer it again, although it rang and rang for half the night. Each time it rang, she hoped it wasn't Alan, and she wished she'd had the sense to turn her father's answering machine on. Most of the calls, she was sure, were from Hannah and her father. And although she'd not found the energy to eat, she'd succeeded in drinking both bottles of the white wine. She'd covered the cut vegetables with some plastic wrapping, and she'd covered and refrigerated the washed rice. The shrimp, which were still in the fridge, would keep well for a night in their marinade, but to be sure, Ruth had added the juice of another lemon. Maybe she'd feel like eating something tomorrow night. Maybe with Scott Saunders. Her father would come back. She half expected to see his car in the driveway in the morning. Ted enjoyed the martyr role. He would have loved to give Ruth the impression that he'd slept in the Volvo all night. But in the morning, the car wasn't there. The phone started ringing at 7 a.m., and Ruth still wouldn't answer it. She tried to find her father's answering machine, but it was not in his workroom where it usually was. Perhaps it had broken, and he'd taken it somewhere to have it repaired. Ruth regretted being in her father's workroom. Above his writing desk, where he wrote only letters nowadays, was the tacked-up list of names of his current squash opponents. Scott Saunders' name and his phone numbers were at the top of the list. "Oh, God, here I go again," she thought. There were two numbers for Saunders, his number in New York and a Bridgehampton number. She dialed the Bridgehampton number, of course. It was not yet 7:30. Ruth could tell by the sound of his voice that she'd awakened him.
"Are you still thinking about playing squash with me?" Ruth asked him.
"It's early," Scott said. "Have you beaten your father already?"
"I want to beat you first," Ruth told him.
"You can try," the lawyer said. "How about dinner after we play?"
"Let's see how the game goes," Ruth said.
"What time?" he asked her.
"The usual time. The same time you play with my father."
"I'll see you at 5, then," Scott told her.
That would give Ruth the whole day to get ready for him.
There were specific shots and serves she liked to practice before she played a left-hander. Her father was a left-hander. In the past, she had never been able to adequately prepare herself for him. Now she believed that playing Scott Saunders would be the perfect warm-up for playing her father. It didn't matter when her father came home. Ruth was sure he would come home, however sheepishly. If her father showed up before she'd played Scott, she would make her father wait. Ruth began by calling Eduardo and Conchita. She didn't want them around the house. She told Conchita she was sorry that she wouldn't see her this visit, and Conchita did what she always did when she talked to Ruth. Conchita cried. Ruth promised she would see Conchita when she was back from Europe, although Ruth doubted she would be visiting her father in Zakopanek then. Ruth told Eduardo that she was going to write all day. She didn't want him mowing the lawn or clipping the hedges or doing whatever he did to the swimming pool. She needed to have a quiet day. On the outside chance that her father wouldn't come back in time to drive her to the airport tomorrow, Ruth told Eduardo that she would call him. Her flight to Munich left early Thursday evening. She would need to leave Zakopanek before 2 or 3 tomorrow afternoon. It was like Ruth Cole to try to organize everything, to try to give her life the structure of her novels. "You always think you can cover any contingency," Hannah had told her once. Ruth thought she could, or that she should. The one thing she should have done, but she didn't, was call Alan. Instead, she let the phone keep ringing, unanswered. The 2 bottles of white wine had not given her a hangover, but they had left a sour taste in her mouth, and her stomach did not welcome the idea of any solid food for breakfast. Ruth found some strawberries, a peach, a banana. She put these in the blender with orange juice and with 3 heaping tablespoons of her father's favorite protein powder. The drink tasted like cold liquid oatmeal, but it made her feel as if she were bouncing off the walls, which was how she wanted to feel. There were only 4 good shots in squash, she dogmatically believed. In the morning, she'd practice her rail and her cross court, good and deep, both of them. Also, there was a dead spot on the front wall of the barn. It was about thigh high and a little to the left of center, well below the service line. Her father had sneakily marked the spot with a smudge of colored chalk. She would practice her aim at that spot. You could hit the ball as hard as you wanted, but if you hit that spot, the ball just died. It came off the wall like a drop shot. She would work on her hard serve in the morning, too. She wanted to hit all her hard shots in the morning. Afterwards, she could ice her shoulder, maybe while sitting in the shallow end of the pool, both before and after she made herself a little lunch. In the afternoon, she'd practice her drop shot. Ruth also had 2 good corner shots, one from mid-court and the other when she was close to one of the side walls. She rarely played a reverse corner. She thought of it as a low percentage or a trick shot, and she didn't like trick shots. She'd work on her soft serve in the afternoon, too. In the low-ceilinged barn, she wouldn't even try her lob serve, but her chip serve had lately been improving. When she sliced through the serve, which she hit low to the front wall, barely above the service line, the ball caught the side wall very low, and its bounce off the floor was very flat. It was as if the ball wanted to lie down. It was still early in the morning when Ruth climbed the ladder from the floor area of the barn, where her father parked his car in the winter months, and pushed open the trap door above her head. The trap door was usually kept closed so that wasps and other insects would not rise to the top of the barn and end up in the squash court. Outside the squash court, on the second floor of the barn, it had once been a hayloft, were a collection of rackets and balls and wristbands and protective eyewear. Tacked to the outside door of the court was a gray photocopy of Ruth's Exeter team. It had been copied from the pages of the 73 Peon, her yearbook. Ruth was in the front row, far right, with the boys' varsity. Her father had copied the yearbook picture and proudly tacked the photocopy on the door. Ruth crumpled up the photocopy after she'd ripped it off the squash court door. She entered the court and stretched for a while, first her hamstrings, then her calves, lastly her right shoulder. She always started by facing the side wall in the left-hand court. She liked to begin with her backhand. She hit her hard volleys and her cross courts before she went to work on her hard serves. She hit nothing but hard serves for the last half hour. She hit them until they were all landing where she wanted them to. "Fuck you, Hannah," Ruth thought. The ball flew off the front wall like something alive. "God damn you, Daddy," she said to herself, the ball flying like a wasp or a bee, only much faster. Her imaginary opponent could never return that ball on the fly. It would be all he could do just to get out of the way. She stopped only because she thought her right arm was going to fall off. Then Ruth took off all her clothes and sat on the bottom step in the shallow end of the pool, enjoying the ice pack that perfectly conformed to her right shoulder. In the glorious Indian summer weather, the sun at midday was warm on her face. The cool water of the pool covered her body, except for her shoulders. The right one was excruciatingly cold from the ice, but in a few minutes it would be wonderfully numb. The terrific thing about hitting a ball that hard, and for that long, was that when she was done, she had absolutely nothing on her mind. Not Scott Saunders and what she was going to do with him after they had played squash. Not her father and what was possible or not possible to do about him. Ruth had not even thought about Alan Albright, whom she should have called. She hadn't thought about Hannah either, not a single thought. In the pool, in the sun, at first feeling but now not feeling the ice, Ruth's life vanished around her. The way night falls, or the way the night gives way to the dawn. When the phone rang, which it did repeatedly, she didn't think about that either. If Scott Saunders had seen Ruth's morning workout, he would have suggested that they play tennis instead, or maybe just have dinner. If Ruth's father had seen the last 20 balls she'd served, he would have known enough not to come home. If Alan Albright had even imagined how far Ruth had removed herself from thought, he would have been very, very worried. And if Hannah Grant, who was still Ruth Cole's best friend, Hannah, at least, knew Ruth better than anyone else knew her, if Hannah had witnessed her friend's mental and physical preparations, Hannah would have known that Scott Saunders, the strawberry blonde lawyer, was facing a day and a night of far more demanding performances than he would be called upon to display in a few fast-paced games of squash. Ruth remembers learning to drive. That afternoon, after she hit her soft shots, she sat in the shallow end of the pool, icing her shoulder and reading The Life of Graham Greene. Ruth was fond of the story of young Graham's first words, which allegedly were, "poor dog," a reference to his sister's dog, which had been run over in the street. Green's nanny had put the dead dog in the baby carriage with Green. Of Green as a child, his biographer wrote, "However young he was, he must have had an instinctive awareness of death from the carcass, the smell, perhaps blood, perhaps the mouth pulled back over the teeth in the snarl of death. Wouldn't there be a growing sense of panic, even nausea, on finding himself shut in irrevocably, committed to sharing the limited confines of a pram with a dead dog?" There are worse things, Ruth Cole thought. In childhood, Green himself had written, in The Ministry of Fear, "we live under the brightness of immortality. Heaven is as near and actual as the seaside. Beside the complicated details of the world stand the simplicities. God is good. The grown-up man or woman knows the answer to every question. There is such a thing as truth, and justice is as measured and faultless as a clock." That hadn't been her childhood. Ruth's mother had left her when she was 4. There was no God. Her father didn't tell the truth, or he wouldn't answer her questions, or both. And as for justice, her father had slept with so many women that Ruth couldn't keep count. On the subject of childhood, Ruth preferred what Green had written in The Power and the Glory. "There is always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in."
Oh, yes, Ruth agreed. But sometimes, she would have argued, there is more than one moment, because there is more than one future. For example, there was the summer of 58, the most obvious moment when the alleged door had opened and the alleged future had been let in. But there was also the spring of 69, when Ruth turned 15 and her father had taught her to drive. For more than 10 years, she'd been asking her father to tell her about the accident that killed Thomas and Timothy. Her father had refused. "When you're old enough to hear it, Ruthie, when you know how to drive," he'd always said. They drove every day, usually first thing in the morning, even on the summer weekends when the Hamptons were overcrowded. Her father wanted her to get used to bad drivers. That summer, on Sunday nights, when the traffic would be backed up in the westbound lane of the Montauk Highway, and the weekend people would already be behaving impatiently, some of them literally dying to get back to New York, Ted would take Ruth out in the old white Volvo. He would drive around until he found what he called a pretty good mess. The traffic would be at a standstill, and some idiots would already have begun passing on the right in the soft shoulder of the road, and others would be trying to break out of the line of cars to turn around and go back to their summer homes, just to wait for an hour or two, or to have a really stiff drink before starting out again. "This looks like a pretty good mess, Ruthie," her father would say. And Ruth would change seats with him, sometimes while the furious driver behind them honked and honked his horn. There were side roads, of course. She knew them all. She could inch ahead on the Montauk Highway and then break free of the traffic and race parallel to the highway on the connecting back roads, always finding a way to break back into the lineup of cars again. Her father would look behind them then, saying, "It appears that you gained on about 7 cars, if that's the same red Saab back there that I think it is." Sometimes she'd drive all the way to the Long Island Expressway before her father would say, "Let's call it a night, Ruthie, or the next thing we know we'll be in Manhattan." On other Sunday nights, the traffic might be so bad that her father considered it a sufficient demonstration of her driving skills if Ruth merely executed a U-turn and drove them home. He emphasized her constant awareness of the rearview mirror, and of course she knew that when she was stopped and waiting to turn left across a lane of oncoming traffic, she must never, ever turn her wheels to the left in anticipation of the turn she was waiting to make. "Never, not ever," her father had told her from her very first driving lesson. But he still hadn't told her the story of what actually happened to Thomas and Timothy. Ruth knew only that Thomas had been driving. "Patience, Ruthie, patience," her father would repeat and repeat to her. "I am patient, Daddy," Ruth would tell him. "I'm still waiting for you to tell me the story, aren't I?" "I mean, be a patient driver, Ruthie. Always be a patient driver." The Volvo, like all of Ted's Volvos, which he began buying in the 60s, was a stick shift. Ted told Ruth to never trust a boy who drove an automatic transmission. "And if you're in the passenger seat and I'm the driver, I never look at you. I don't care what you say or what kind of fit you're having, even if you're choking," Ted said. "If I'm driving the car, I can talk to you, but I don't look at you, not ever. And when you're the driver, you don't look at me or anyone who might be in the passenger seat. Not until you get off the road and stop the car. You got it?"
"Got it," Ruth said.
"And if you're out on a date and the boy is driving, if he looks at you for whatever reason, you tell him not to look at you or else you'll get out and walk. Or you tell him to let you drive the car. You got that, too?" her father asked.
"I got it," Ruth said. "Tell me what happened to Thomas and Timothy."
But all her father said was, "And if you're upset, like something you're thinking about suddenly upsets you and you start to cry, and you can't see the road clearly because of your tears, just suppose you're bawling your eyes out for whatever reason."
"Okay, okay, I got it," Ruth told him.
"Well, if you ever get like that, crying so hard that you can't see the road, you just pull over to the side of the road and stop."
"What about the accident?" Ruth asked.
"Were you there?
Were you and Mommy in the car?
In the shallow end of the swimming pool, Ruth felt the ice melting on her shoulder. The cold trickle followed the line of her collarbone and made its way across her chest into the warmer water of the pool. The sun was going down behind the enormous privet. She thought of Graham Greene's father, the schoolmaster, whose advice to his former pupils, who adored him, was odd but in its own way charming. "Remember to be faithful to your future wife," he'd said to a boy who was leaving school to join the army in 1918. And to another, just prior to his confirmation, Charles Green had said, "An army of women live on the lust of men." Where had this army of women gone? Ruth guessed that Hannah was one of the alleged army's lost soldiers. All Ruth's life, not only since she'd begun to read, but from the first time her father had told her a story, books and the characters in them had entered her life and remained fixed there. Books and the characters in them were more fixed in Ruth's life than her father and her best friend, not to mention the men in her life who, for the most part, had proven themselves to be almost as unreliable as Ted and Hannah had proven to be. All life long, Graham Greene had written in his autobiography, A Sort of Life, my instinct has been to abandon anything for which I have no talent. A good instinct. But were Ruth to put it into action, she would perforce have nothing further to do with men. Among the men she'd known, only Alan seemed admirable and constant. Yet, as she sat in the pool readying herself for her test with Scott Saunders, only Alan's lupine teeth were clearly in her mind's eye, and the hair on the back of his hands. He had too much hair there. She'd not enjoyed playing squash with Alan. He was a good athlete and a well-coached squash player, but Alan was too large for the court, too dangerous in his lunging, looping movements. Yet Alan would never try to hurt or intimidate her. And although she'd lost to him twice, Ruth didn't doubt that she would eventually beat him. It was merely a matter of learning to keep out of his way, while at the same time not being afraid of his backswing. The two times she'd lost to him, Ruth had yielded the tee. Next time, if there was a next time, Ruth was determined not to give up her preferred position on the court to him. As she enjoyed the last of the melting ice, she thought, at worst it might mean some stitches in an eyebrow or a broken nose. Besides, if Alan hit her with his racket, he would feel terrible about it. Thereafter, Alan would yield his preferred position on the court to her. In no time, whether he hit her or not, she would be beating him easily. Then Ruth thought, why bother to beat him? How could she ever consider giving up men? To an even greater extent, it was women she didn't trust. She'd been sitting for too long in the swimming pool, in the chill of the late afternoon shade, not to mention the clammy cold of the ice pack, which had melted on her shoulder. The chill gave her a touch of November in the Indian summer weather. It reminded Ruth of that November night in 1969, when her father had given her what he called the ultimate driving lesson and the penultimate driving test. She wouldn't be 16 until the spring of the following year when she would take her actual driving test. She would pass it easily, without the slightest difficulty. But that November night, her father had forewarned her, "For your sake, Ruthie, I hope you never have a tougher driving test than this one. Let's go."
"Go where?" she'd asked.
It was the Sunday night of the long Thanksgiving weekend. The pool was already covered for winter, the fruit trees denuded of fruit and leaves. Even the privet was bare, standing skeletally, stiffly moving in the wind. On the northern horizon was a glow, the headlights of the cars that were already at a standstill in the westbound lane of the Montauk Highway, the weekenders on their way back to New York.
Normally, the drive took 2 hours, at the most 3.
"I feel like the lights of Manhattan tonight," Ted told his daughter. "I want to see if the Christmas decorations are already in place on Park Avenue. I want to have a drink at the Stanhope Bar. I had a 1910 Armagnac there once. Of course, I don't drink Armagnac anymore, but I'd like to have something as good as that again. A really good glass of port, maybe. Let's go."
"You want to drive to New York tonight, Daddy?" Ruth asked.
Short of the end of the Labor Day weekend, or immediately following the 4th of July, it was arguably the worst night of the year to drive to New York.
"No, I don't want to drive to New York, Ruthie. I can't drive to New York because I've been drinking. I've had 3 beers and a whole bottle of red wine. The one thing I promised your mother was that I'd never drink and drive, at least not with you in the car. You're the driver, Ruthie."
"I've never driven to New York," Ruth said. It wouldn't have been much of a test if she had.
When they finally got on the Long Island Expressway at Manorville, Ted said,
"Get in the passing lane, Ruthie. Maintain the speed limit. Remember your rear-view mirror. If someone's coming up behind you and you have enough time to move to the center lane, and if you have enough room, then move over. But if someone's coming up on you, hog wild to pass, let them pass you on the right."
"Isn't this illegal, Daddy?" she asked him. She thought that her learner's permit had some restrictions, like maybe she wasn't supposed to drive at night or not beyond a 15-mile radius of where she lived. She didn't know.
"You can't learn everything you need to know legally," her father told her.
She had to concentrate so hard on the driving that it was one of the few times they'd been out in the old white Volvo together when she didn't ask him to tell her about what happened to Thomas and Timothy. Ted waited until they were approaching Flushing Meadows. Then, without any warning, he began to tell her the story in exactly the same way that he'd told it to Eddie O'Hare, with Ted Cole in the third person, as if Ted were just another character in the story, and a minor character at that. Ted interrupted the part about how much he and Marion had had to drink, and why Thomas had been the obvious choice, the designated driver, to tell Ruth to get out of the passing lane and into the far right lane instead.
"You get on the Grand Central Parkway here, Ruthie," her father casually said.
She had to change lanes a little too fast, but she managed it. Soon she saw Shea Stadium off to her right. At the part in the story where he and Marion were arguing about the best place to make a left turn, Ted interrupted himself again, this time to tell Ruth to take Northern Boulevard through Queens. She knew that the old white Volvo tended to overheat in stop-and-go traffic, but when she mentioned it, her father said,
"Just don't ride the clutch, Ruthie. If you're stopped for a while, take it out of gear, put it in neutral, and step on your brake. Keep your foot off your clutch as much as you can, and remember your rear-view mirror."
By then she was crying. It was after the snowplow scene, when her mother knew that Thomas was dead, but she didn't yet know about Timothy. Marion kept asking Ted if Timmy was all right, and Ted wouldn't tell her. He'd just watched Timmy die, but he couldn't speak. They came over the Queensboro Bridge into Manhattan at the moment in the story when her father was explaining about Timothy's left leg, how the snowplow had severed it at mid-thigh, and that when they tried to take the body away, they had to leave the leg behind.
"I can't see the road, Daddy," Ruth told him.
"Well, there's no place to pull over, is there?" her father asked her. "You'll just have to keep going, won't you?"
Then he told her the part where her mother had noticed her brother's shoe.
"Oh, Ted, look, he's going to need his shoe," Marion had said, not realizing that Timmy's shoe was still attached to Timmy's leg, and so on.
Ruth headed uptown on 3rd Avenue.
"I'll tell you when to cut over to Park," her father told her. "There's a place on Park Avenue where the Christmas decorations are especially worth seeing."
"I'm crying too much. I can't see where I'm going, Daddy," Ruth told him again.
"But that's the test, Ruthie. The test is sometimes there's no place to pull over. Sometimes you can't stop, and you have to find a way to keep going. You got it?"
"Got it," she said.
"So," her father said, "now you know everything."
Ruth realized later that she'd also passed that part of the test, which had not been mentioned. She'd never looked at him. He'd sat unseen in the passenger seat. All the while that her father was telling the story, Ruth had never taken her eyes from the road or from the rear-view mirror. That had been part of the test, too. That November night in 69, her father had made her drive up Park Avenue, all the while commenting on the Christmas decorations. Somewhere in the upper 80s, he'd told her to cut over to Fifth. Then they'd come down Fifth Avenue to the Stanhope, which was opposite the Met. It was the first time she'd heard the flags at the Met snapping in the wind. Her father had told her to give the keys of the old white Volvo to the doorman. His name was Manny. Ruth had been impressed that the doorman knew her father. But they all knew her father at the Stanhope. He must have been a frequent guest. It's where he brings women, Ruth realized. "Always stay here when you can afford it, Ruthie," her father had told her. "It's a good hotel." It was, and she always did. Since 1980, she'd been able to afford it. That night, they'd gone into the bar, and her father changed his mind about the port. He'd ordered a bottle of an excellent Pommard instead. Ted finished most of the wine while Ruth drank a double espresso, knowing that she had to drive back to Sagaponack. All the time they sat in the bar, Ruth felt that she was still gripping the steering wheel. And although it would have been permissible to look at her father in the bar before they got back in the old white Volvo, she couldn't look at him. It was as if he were still telling her the terrible story. It was after midnight when her father directed her up Madison Avenue. Somewhere in the upper 90s, he told her to turn east. They took FDR Drive to the Triborough, then the Grand Central Parkway to the LIE, where her father fell asleep. Ruth remembered that Manorville was the exit she wanted. She didn't have to wake her father to ask him how to get home. She was driving against the holiday traffic. The headlights of the horde returning to the city were constantly in her eyes, but there was almost no one headed in her direction. A couple of times, she opened up the old white Volvo just to see how fast it could go. She reached 85 twice, and 90 once. But at those speeds, a shimmy in the front end frightened her. Most of the way, she stuck to the speed limit and thought about the story of how her brothers had died, especially the part about her mother trying to save Timmy's shoe. Her father didn't wake up until she was driving through Bridgehampton. "How come you didn't take the back roads?" he asked.
"I felt like having all the town lights around me and the headlights of the other cars," Ruth said.
"Oh," her father said, as if he were falling back to sleep.
"What kind of shoe was it?" Ruth asked.
"It was a basketball shoe, Timmy's favorite."
"High tops?" she guessed.
"Right."
"Got it," Ruth said, turning onto Sag Main. Although at that moment there were no other cars in sight of the Volvo, Ruth put her directional signal on. A full 50 yards before she turned, she put on her blinker.
"Good driving, Ruthie," her father told her. "If you ever have a tougher drive than this, I trust you to remember what you've learned."
Ruth was shivering when she finally got out of the pool. She knew she should warm up before she started playing squash with Scott Saunders, but both her memories of learning to drive and the Graham Greene biography had depressed her. It wasn't Norman Sherry's fault, but the Greene biography had taken a turn that Ruth opposed. Mr. Sherry was convinced that for every major character in a Graham Greene novel, there existed a real-life counterpart. In an interview in the Times, Greene himself had told V.S. Pritchett, "I cannot invent." Yet in the same interview, while admitting that his characters were an amalgam of bits of real people, Greene also denied taking his characters from real life. "Real people are crowded out by imaginary ones," he'd said. "Real people are too limiting." But for too many pages of the biography, Mr. Sherry went on and on about the real people. Ruth was particularly saddened by Greene's early love life.
What his biographer called his obsessional love for the ardent Catholic who would eventually become Green's wife was precisely the kind of thing Ruth didn't want to know about a writer whose writing she loved. "There is a splinter of ice in the heart of a writer," Green had written in A Sort of Life. But in the daily letters that young Graham wrote to Vivian, his wife-to-be, Ruth saw only the familiar pathos of a man who was smitten. Ruth had never been smitten. Possibly what contributed to her reluctance to welcome Alan's proposal of marriage was her awareness of how smitten Alan was with her. She'd stopped reading The Life of Graham Greene on page 338, the beginning of the 24th chapter, which was called Marriage at Last. It was a pity that Ruth stopped reading there, for near the end of that chapter, she would have found something that might have made her like Graham Greene and his bride-to-be a little better. When the couple had finally married and were on their honeymoon, Vivian presented Graham with a sealed letter that Vivian's intrusive mother had given her, a letter on sex instruction. But Vivian handed it to Green unopened. He read it and immediately tore it up. Vivian never got to read the letter. Ruth would have appreciated that the new Mrs. Green decided she could manage well enough without her mother's advice. As for Marriage at Last, why did the chapter title, the phrase itself, depress her? Was it the way she would get married to? It sounded like the title of a novel Ruth Cole would never write or even want to read. Ruth thought she should stick to rereading Graham Greene. She was sure that she didn't want to know anything more about his life. Here she was brooding about what Hannah called her favorite subject, which was her tireless scrutiny of the relationship between what was real and what was invented. But the mere thought of Hannah returned Ruth to the present. She didn't want Scott Saunders to see her naked in the pool, not yet. She went into the house and dressed in some clean, dry clothes for Squash. She put some talcum powder in the right front pocket of her shorts. It would keep her racket hand dry and smooth, no blisters. She had already chilled the white wine, but now she arranged the rice in the electric steamer. All she would have to do later was push a button to turn it on. She had already set the dining room table, two place settings. At last she climbed the ladder to the second floor of the barn, and after she'd stretched, she began to warm up the ball. She fell into an easy rhythm. Four forehands down the wall, then she would hit the telltale tin. Four backhand rails, and then the tin again. Each time she hit the tin, aiming deliberately low, she hit the ball hard enough so that the resounding tin was loud. In an actual game, Ruth almost never hit the tin. In a tough match, maybe she would hit it twice. But she wanted to be sure that when Scott Saunders arrived, he would hear her hitting the tin. And as he climbed the ladder to come play with her, he would be thinking, for a so-called pretty good player, she sure hits the tin a lot. Then, when they started to play, it would come as quite a surprise to him that Ruth rarely hit the tin at all. You could feel a little shiver in the squash court whenever someone climbed the ladder to the second floor of the barn. When Ruth felt that shiver, she counted five more shots, hitting the tin the fifth time. She could easily hit all five shots in the time it took her to say, under her breath, "Daddy with Hannah Grant." Scott tapped twice on the door of the squash court with his racket. Then he cautiously opened the door. "Hi," he said. "I hope you haven't been practicing for me." "Oh, just a little bit," Ruth said. Two drawers. She spotted him the first 5 points. Ruth wanted to see how he moved. He was reasonably quick, but he swung his racket like a tennis player. He didn't snap his wrist. And he had only one serve, a hard one, right at her. It was usually too high. She could step out of its way and return it off the back wall. And Scott's return of serve was weak. The ball fell to the floor at midcourt. Ruth could usually kill it with a corner shot. Either she had him running from the back wall to the front, or from one back corner to the other.
Ruth took the first game 15-8, before Scott had figured out how good she really was. Scott was one of those players who overestimated his own ability. When he was losing, his first thought was that his game was a little off. It wouldn't occur to him until the third or fourth game that he was being outplayed. Ruth tried to keep the score close in the next two games because she enjoyed seeing Scott run. She won the second game 15-6 and the third 15-9. Scott Saunders was in very good shape, but after the third game, he needed the water bottle. Ruth didn't drink any water. Scott was doing all the running. He hadn't quite got his wind back when he faltered the first serve of the fourth game. Ruth could detect his frustration like a sudden odor.
"I can't believe that your father still beats you," he said between breaths.
"Oh, I'll beat him one day," Ruth said. "Maybe next time." She won the fourth game 15-5. While he was chasing a drop shot into the front corner, Scott slipped in a puddle of his own sweat. He slid on his hip and hit his head against the tin.
"Are you okay?" Ruth asked him. "Do you want to stop?"
"Let's play one more game," he snapped at her.
Ruth didn't like his attitude. She beat him 15-1 in their last game, his only point coming when she tried, against her better judgment, a reverse corner that hit the tin. It was the one time she hit the tin in five games. Ruth was mad at herself for attempting the reverse corner. It confirmed her opinion of low-percentage shots. If she'd just kept the ball in play, she was sure she would have taken the last game 15-0. But losing 15-1 had been bad enough for Scott Saunders. Ruth couldn't be sure if he was pouting or just making an unusually contorted facial expression until he got his wind back. They were leaving the court when a wasp flew in the open door and Scott took an awkward swipe at it with his racket. He missed. The wasp zigged and zagged. Its erratic darting flight was on course to the ceiling where it would safely be out of reach when Ruth caught the wasp in midair with her backhand. Some say it's the toughest shot in squash, an overhead backhand volley. The strings of her racket cut the wasp's segmented body in two.
"Good get," Scott said, as if he were about to be sick.
Ruth sat on the edge of the deck beside the swimming pool. She took off her shoes and socks, cooling her feet in the water. Scott didn't seem to know what to do. He was used to taking off all his clothes and stepping into the outdoor shower with Ted. Ruth would have to do it first. She stood up and took off her shorts. She pulled her T-shirt off, dreading the potential awkwardness, the usual unwanted acrobatics of wriggling out of her sweaty sports bra. But she was able to take the spandex bra off without an embarrassing struggle. She took her underpants off last and walked into the shower stall without looking at Scott. She'd already soaped herself and was standing under the running water when he stepped into the shower stall with her and turned on his shower head. She had shampooed her hair and was rinsing the shampoo out when she asked him if he was allergic to shrimp.
"No, I like shrimp," he told her.
With her eyes closed, rinsing off the shampoo, she guessed that he had to be looking at her breasts.
"Good, because that's what we're having for dinner," Ruth told him.
She shut off her shower and stepped out on the deck. Then she dove into the deep end of the pool. When she surfaced, Scott was still standing on the deck. He was looking beyond her.
"Isn't there a wine glass at the bottom of the pool?" he asked. "Did you recently have a party?"
"No, my father recently had a party," Ruth answered, treading water.
Scott Saunders had a bigger cock than she'd first thought. The lawyer dove to the bottom of the deep end and brought up the wine glass.
"It must have been a moderately wild party," Scott said.
"My father is more than moderately wild," Ruth replied. She floated on her back. It always amused her that when she did this, the better part of her breasts were out of the water.
When Hannah tried it, she could scarcely manage to make her nipples rise above the surface. "You have beautiful breasts," Scott told Ruth. He treaded water next to her. He filled the wine glass with water. Then he poured the water on her breasts.
"My mother probably had better ones," Ruth said. "What do you know about my mother?" she asked him.
"Nothing. I've just heard some rumors," Scott admitted.
They're probably true, Ruth said. You may know almost as much about her as I do.
She swam to the shallow end, and he followed, still holding the wine glass. If he hadn't been carrying the stupid glass, he would have already touched her. Ruth got out of the pool and wrapped herself in a towel. She saw Scott drying himself, meticulously, before she walked into the house, her towel around her waist, her breasts still bare.
"If you put your clothes in the dryer, they'll be dry after dinner," she called to him.
He followed her inside. His towel was around his waist.
"Tell me if you're cold," she said. "You can wear something of my father's."
"I feel fine in the towel," he told her.
Ruth started the rice steamer and opened a bottle of white wine. She poured a glass for Scott and one for herself. She looked pretty good with just the towel around her waist and her breasts bare.
"I feel fine in the towel, too," she told him.
She let him kiss her then. He cupped one of her breasts in his hand.
"I didn't expect this," he said to her.
No kidding, Ruth thought.
When she'd made up her mind about somebody, it was the height of boredom to wait for the man to seduce her. She hadn't been with anybody for 4, almost 5 months. She didn't feel like waiting.
"Let me show you something," Ruth said to Scott.
She led him into her father's workroom, where she opened the bottommost drawer of Ted's so-called writing desk. The drawer was full of black-and-white Polaroid prints. There were hundreds of them, and about a dozen tubular containers of Polaroid print coater. The print coater gave the whole drawer and all the photographs a bad smell. Ruth handed Scott a stack of the Polaroids without comment. They were the pictures Ted had taken of his models both before and after he drew them. Ted told his models that the photos were necessary so that he could continue to work on the drawings when the models weren't there. He needed the photos for reference. In fact, he never continued to work on the drawings. He just wanted the photographs. When Scott finished looking at one stack of photos, Ruth showed him another. The pictures had that amateur quality which most really bad pornography has, that the models themselves were not professional models was only part of it. There was an awkwardness to their poses that suggested sexual shame. But there was also a sense of haste and carelessness about the photographs themselves.
"Why are you showing me these?" Scott asked Ruth.
"Do they turn you on?" she asked him.
"You turn me on," he told her.
"I guess they turn my father on," Ruth said. "They're all his models. He's fucked every single one of them."
Scott was leafing quickly through the photographs without really looking at them. It was hard to look at the photos if he weren't alone.
"There are a lot of women here," he said.
"Yesterday and the day before, my father fucked my best friend," Ruth told him.
"Your father fucked your best friend," Scott repeated stupidly.
"We're what an idiot sociology major would call a dysfunctional family," Ruth said.
"I was a sociology major," Scott Saunders admitted.
"What did you learn?" Ruth asked him. She was putting the Polaroids back in the bottommost drawer. The smell from the print coater was strong enough to make her gag. In a way, it was a worse smell than the squid ink. Ruth had first found the photographs in her father's bottommost drawer when she'd been 12 years old.
"I decided to go to law school. That's what I learned from sociology," the strawberry blonde lawyer said.
"Have you heard some rumors about my brothers, too?" Ruth asked him. "They're dead," she added.
"I think I heard something," Scott answered. "Wasn't it a long time ago?"
"I'll show you a picture of them. They were good-looking guys," Ruth said, taking Scott's hand.
She led him up the carpeted stairs. Their bare feet didn't make a sound. The lid of the rice steamer was rattling. The dryer was running, too, chiefly the sound of something clicking or tapping against the revolving drum of the dryer. Ruth took Scott into the master bedroom, where the big bed was in unmade disarray. Ruth could almost see the body imprints of her father and Hannah in the tangled sheets.
"There they are,"
Ruth said to Scott, pointing to the picture of her brothers. Squinting at the photograph, Scott tried to read the Latin inscription above the doorway.
"I guess you didn't learn Latin as a sociology major," Ruth said.
"There's a lot of Latin in the law," he told her.
"My brothers were good-looking guys, weren't they?"
Ruth asked him.
"Yes, they were," Scott said. "Doesn't venite mean come?" he asked her.
"Come hither, boys, and become men," Ruth translated for him.
"Now there's a challenge," Scott Saunders said. "I liked being a boy better."
"My father never stopped being a boy," Ruth said.
"Is this your father's bedroom?" Scott asked her.
"Check out the top drawer. The drawer under the night table," Ruth told him. "Go on. Open it." Scott hesitated. He was probably thinking that there were more Polaroids in the drawer. "Don't worry, there are no photographs in there," Ruth said. Scott opened the drawer. It was full of condoms in brightly colored foil wrappers, and there was a large tube of lubricating jelly.
"So, I guess this is your father's bedroom," Scott said, looking around nervously.
"That's a drawer full of a boy's stuff, if I ever saw one," Ruth said. She'd first discovered the condoms and the lubricating jelly in her father's night table drawer when she was about 9 or 10.
"Where is your father?" Scott asked her.
"I don't know," she said.
"You're not expecting him?" Scott asked.
"If I had to guess, I'd say I was expecting him about mid-morning tomorrow," Ruth said. Scott Saunders looked at all the condoms in the open drawer.
"God, I haven't worn a condom since I was in college," he said.
"You're going to have to wear one now," Ruth told him. She took the towel off from around her waist. Then she sat naked on the unmade bed. "If you've forgotten how a condom works, I can remind you," she added. Scott picked a condom in a blue wrapper. He kissed her for a long time, and he licked her for an even longer time. She didn't need any of the jelly in her father's night-table drawer. She came just a few seconds after he was inside her, and she felt him come only a moment later. Nearly the whole time, but especially when Scott was licking her, Ruth watched the open door of her father's bedroom. She listened for her father's footsteps on the stairs or in the upstairs hall, but all she could hear was the clicking or tapping noise in the dryer. The lid of the rice steamer wasn't rattling anymore. The rice was cooked. And when Scott entered her, and she knew she was going to come, almost instantly, the rest of it would be over very quickly, too, Ruth thought, "Come home now, Daddy. Come upstairs and see me now." But Ted didn't come home in time to see his daughter as she would have liked him to see her. Pain in an unfamiliar place. Hannah had used too much soy sauce in the marinade. Also, the shrimp had languished in the marinade for more than 24 hours. They didn't taste like shrimp anymore. But this hardly stopped Ruth and Scott from eating them all, and all the rice and the stir-fried vegetables, and all of some kind of cucumber chutney that had seen better days. They also drank a second bottle of white wine, and Ruth opened a bottle of red wine to have with the cheese and fruit. They finished the bottle of red wine, too. They ate and drank, wearing just the towels around their waists, Ruth with her breasts defiantly bare. She hoped that her father would walk into the dining room, but he did not. And despite the conviviality of her wining and dining with Scott Saunders, not to mention the seeming success of their highly charged sexual encounter, their dinner table conversation was strained. Scott told Ruth that his divorce had been amicable and that he enjoyed an amiable relationship with his ex-wife. Recently divorced men talked entirely too much about their ex-wives. If the divorce had been truly amicable, why talk about it? Ruth asked Scott to tell her what kind of law he practiced, but he said that it wasn't interesting. It had something to do with real estate. Scott also confessed to not having read her novels.
He'd tried the second one before the fall of Saigon. He thought it might be a war novel. He'd gone to considerable trouble as a young man not to be drafted during the Vietnam War, but the book had struck him as what he called a women's novel. The phrase never failed to make Ruth think of a wide array of feminine hygiene products. "About female friendship, wasn't it?" he asked. But his ex-wife had read everything Ruth Cole had written. "She's your biggest fan," Scott Saunders said. The ex-wife, again. Then he asked Ruth if she was seeing anyone. She tried to tell him about Alan without mentioning any names. The issue of marriage existed for her as a subject separate from Alan. Her attraction to marriage was deep, Ruth told Scott, while at the same time her fear of it was stultifying.
"You mean you're more attracted to it than you are afraid of it?" the lawyer asked.
"How does that passage from George Eliot go? I once liked it so much that I wrote it down," Ruth told him. "What greater thing is there for two human souls than to feel that they are joined for life? But..."
"Did he stay married?" Scott asked her.
"Who?" Ruth said.
"George Eliot. Did he stay married?"
"Maybe if I just get up and start doing the dishes, he'll get bored and go home," Ruth thought.
But when she was loading the dishwasher, Scott stood behind her and fondled her breasts. She felt his hard on poking against her through both their towels.
"I want to do it to you this way, from behind," he said. "I don't like it that way," she said.
"I don't mean in the wrong hole," he told her crudely. "I mean the right hole, but from behind."
"I know what you mean," Ruth told him.
He was fondling her breasts so persistently that she had some difficulty getting the wine glasses to fit properly in the top rack of the dishwasher.
"I don't like it from behind, period," Ruth added.
"How do you like it, then?" he asked her.
It was clear to her that he expected to do it again. "I'll show you," she said, "as soon as I finish loading the dishwasher."
It was no accident that Ruth had left the front door unlocked, or the lights on, in both the downstairs and the upstairs hall. She'd also left the door to her father's bedroom open in the receding hope that her father would return and find her in the act of making love to Scott. But this was not to be. Ruth straddled Scott. She sat on him for the longest time. She nearly rocked herself to sleep in this position. They'd both had too much to drink. When she could tell by how he held his breath that he was about to come, she dropped her weight on his chest and, holding tight to his shoulders, rolled him on top of her because she couldn't stand to see the look that transformed most men's faces when they came. Ruth didn't know, of course. She would never know that this had been a manner of making love that her mother had also preferred with Eddie O'Hare. Ruth lay in bed, listening to Scott flushing the condom down the toilet in the master bathroom. After Scott had come back to bed, he'd almost instantly fallen asleep, Ruth lay awake listening to the dishwasher. It was in the final rinse cycle, and it sounded to her as if two wine glasses were rubbing against each other. Scott Saunders had fallen asleep with his left hand holding her right breast. Ruth was not terribly comfortable, but now that Scott was sound asleep and snoring, his hand no longer held her breast. Rather, the hand pressed its dead weight against her like a sleeping dog's paw. Ruth tried to remember the rest of the George Eliot passage about marriage. She didn't even know which George Eliot novel the quotation was from, although Ruth distinctly recalled copying the passage long ago in one of her diaries. Now, falling asleep, it occurred to Ruth that Eddie O'Hare might know which novel the passage was from. At least it would give her an excuse to call him. In fact, if she'd called Eddie, he wouldn't have known the passage. Eddie wasn't a George Eliot fan. Eddie would have called his father. Minty O'Hare, even in his retirement, would have known which George Eliot novel the passage came from. "To strengthen each other in all labor," Ruth whispered to herself, reciting the passage from memory.
She had no fear of waking up Scott, not the way he was snoring, and the wine glasses went on grinding together in the dishwasher. It had been so long since the telephone had rung that Ruth felt the world had fallen sound asleep. Whoever had been calling and calling had given up. To rest on each other in all sorrow. George Eliot had written about marriage. To minister to each other in all pain, Ruth recited. To be one with each other in silent, unspeakable memories at the moment of the last parting. It sounded like a pretty good idea to Ruth Cole, who finally fell asleep beside an unknown man whose breathing was as loud as a brass band. The phone rang almost a dozen times before Ruth heard it. Scott Saunders didn't wake up until Ruth answered the phone. She felt his paw revive against her breast. "Hello?" Ruth said. When she opened her eyes, it took her a second to recognize her father's digital clock. It took a second, too, before the paw on her breast reminded her of where she was and in what circumstances, and why she hadn't wanted to answer the phone. "I've been so worried about you," Alan Albright said. "I've been calling and calling."
"Oh, Alan," Ruth said. It was a little after 2 in the morning. The dishwasher had stopped. The dryer had stopped long before the dishwasher. The paw against her breast had become a hand again. It cupped her breast firmly. "I was asleep," Ruth said.
"I thought you might be dead," Alan told her.
"I had a fight with my father. I haven't been answering the phone," Ruth explained. The hand had let go of her breast.
She saw the same hand reach across her body and open the top drawer under the night table. The hand chose a condom, another blue one. The hand also removed the tube of jelly from the drawer.
"I tried to call your friend Hannah. Wasn't she going to be out there with you?" Alan asked. "But I kept getting her answering machine. I don't even know if she got my message."
"Don't talk to Hannah. I had a fight with her, too," Ruth told him.
"So you're all alone out there?" Alan asked her.
"Yes, I'm alone," Ruth answered.
She tried to lie on her side with her legs tight together, but Scott Saunders was strong. He was able to pull her up on her knees. He'd put enough lubricating jelly on the condom so that he slipped inside her with surprising ease. It momentarily took her breath away.
"What?"
Alan said.
"I feel terrible," Ruth told him. "Let me call you in the morning."
"I could come out there," Alan said.
"No," Ruth said, to Alan and to Scott. She rested her weight on her elbows and her forehead. She kept trying to lie flat on her stomach, but Scott pulled her hips into him so forcefully that it was more comfortable for her to stay on her knees. The top of her head kept bumping the headboard of the bed. She wanted to say good night to Alan, but her breathing was jerky. Besides, Scott had jammed her so far forward that she couldn't reach the night table to return the telephone to its cradle.
"I love you," Alan told her. "I'm sorry."
"No, I'm sorry," Ruth managed to say, before Scott Saunders took the phone from her and hung it up.
Then he cupped both her breasts in his hands, squeezing them until they ached, and he humped her from behind like a dog, the way Eddie O'Hare had humped her mother. Fortunately, Ruth did not remember the episode of the inadequate lampshade in great detail, but her memory was sufficient for her to never want to be in the same position herself. Now she was in it. She had to push back against Scott with all her strength, or her head would have kept bumping against the headboard. She'd been sleeping on her right shoulder, which was sore from all the squash, but her right shoulder didn't hurt her as much as Scott Saunders hurt her. There was something about the position itself that hurt her. It wasn't only a matter of her memory of it. And Scott's grip on her breasts was much rougher than she liked.
"Please, stop," she asked him,
but he could feel her pushing her hips back against him, and he humped her all the harder. When he was finished with her, Ruth lay on her left side, facing the empty bed. She listened to Scott flushing away another condom. At first she felt she was bleeding, but it was only an excess of the lubricating jelly. When Scott came back to bed, he tried to touch her breasts again. Ruth pushed his hand away. I told you I didn't like it that way, she said to him.
I got the right hole, didn't I? He asked her.
I told you I didn't like it from behind, period, she said.
Come on, your hips were moving. You liked it, Scott told her. She knew that she'd had to move her hips against him so that she wouldn't keep bumping her head on the headboard. Maybe he knew it too, but all Ruth said was, "You hurt me."
Come on, Scott said. He reached for her breasts again, but she pushed his hand away. When a woman says no, when she says, "Please stop," well, what's it mean when a man won't stop? Ruth asked. Isn't that a little like rape?
He rolled over on the bed, turning his back to her.
Come on, you're talking to a lawyer, he told her.
No, I'm talking to an asshole, she said.
So, who was the phone call? Scott asked. Someone important?
More important than you are, Ruth told him.
Given the circumstances, the lawyer said, I presume he isn't that important.
Please get out of here, Ruth said. Please just go.
Okay, okay, he told her.
But when she returned from the bathroom, he'd fallen back to sleep. He was lying on his side, his arms reaching out to what had been her side of the bed. He was taking up the whole bed.
Get up! Get out of here! She shouted.
But either he was sound asleep again, or he was pretending to be sound asleep. In retrospect, Ruth might have deliberated a little longer on her next decision. She opened the condom drawer and took out the tube of lubricating jelly, which she squirted into Scott's exposed left ear. The stuff came out of the tube a lot faster than she expected. It had a more liquid consistency than normal jelly, and it woke up Scott Saunders in a hurry.
Time to go, Ruth reminded him.
She was completely unprepared for him to hit her. With left-handers, there's always something you don't see coming. Scott hit her only once, but it was a solid shot. 1 second he was holding his left ear with his left hand, then he was out of the bed, facing her. He caught Ruth on her right cheekbone with a straight left that she never saw. As she lay on the rug, approximately where she'd seen Hannah's open suitcase, Ruth realized that Hannah had been right again. Ruth's alleged instincts for detecting a man's capacity for violence against women, even on the very first date, were not the instincts she'd thought she had. Hannah had told her she'd just been lucky. You just haven't had that date, Hannah had warned her. Now she had. Ruth let the room stop spinning before she tried to move. Again she thought she was bleeding, but it was only the jelly that Scott had got on his left hand when he'd touched his left ear. She lay in a fetal position, her knees pulled up to her chest. The skin over her right cheekbone felt stretched too tightly, and she sensed an unnatural warmth on her face. When she blinked her eyes, she saw stars, but when she held her eyes open, the stars disappeared after a few seconds. She was locked in a closet again. Not since childhood had she been this afraid. She couldn't see Scott Saunders, but she called to him.
I'll get you your clothes, she told him. They're still in the dryer.
I know where the dryer is, he said sullenly. As if she were not part of her body, she saw him step over the spot where she lay on the rug. She heard the stairs creak as he went down them.
When she got up, she was momentarily dizzy, the feeling that she might throw up lasted longer. She carried the sick-to-her-stomach feeling downstairs, where she walked directly through the dining room to the darkened terrace. The cool night air instantly revived her. Indian summer is over, she thought, dipping the toes of one foot in the pool. The silky, smooth water was warmer than the air. Later she would go in the pool, but right now she didn't want to be naked. She found her old squash clothes on the deck near the outdoor shower. They were damp with cold sweat and dew. The T-shirt made her shiver. She didn't bother with her underpants, her bra, or her socks. Just the T-shirt, her shorts, and her shoes would suffice. She stretched her sore right shoulder. Her shoulder would suffice, too. Scott Saunders' squash racket was leaning, handle up, racket head down, against the outdoor shower stall. It was too heavy a racket for her, and the grip was too big for her hand. But it wasn't as if she intended to play a whole match with it. It'll be fine, Ruth thought, going back inside the house. She found Scott in the laundry room. He'd not bothered to put on his jock. He'd pulled on his shorts and stuck the jock in his right front pocket. He'd put his socks in the left front pocket of his shorts. He'd put on his shoes, but he'd left them unlaced. He was pulling his T-shirt over his head when Ruth caught him with a low backhand that crumpled his right knee. Scott managed to pop his head through the head hole in his T-shirt maybe a half second before Ruth struck him full in the face with a rising forehand. He covered his face with his hands, but Ruth had turned the racket head sideways. She slashed at his elbows, one backhand, one forehand, both elbows. His arms were numb. He couldn't raise his arms to protect his face. He was already bleeding over one eyebrow. She took two overhead shots at both his collarbones, snapping several strings on the racket face with the first blow and completely separating the racket head from the handle with the second. The handle was still a pretty effective weapon. She kept slashing at him, hitting him wherever he exposed himself. He tried to crawl out of the laundry room on all fours, but his right knee wouldn't support his weight and his left collarbone was broken. Therefore, Scott couldn't crawl. All the time she was hitting him, Ruth repeated the scores of their squash games, a fairly humiliating litany. 15-8, 15-6, 15-9, 15-5, 15-1. When Scott lay in a collapsed position of lopsided prayer, with his hands hiding his face, Ruth stopped hitting him. Although she didn't help him, she let him get to his feet. His damaged right knee gave him a jolting limp, which doubtless caused him considerable pain in his broken left collarbone. The cut over his eyebrow was a real bleeder. At a safe distance, Ruth followed Scott to his car. She still held his racket handle. It felt about the right weight for her now that the racket head was gone. She had a passing concern for Scott's right knee, but only if it might affect his driving. Then she saw that he drove a car with an automatic transmission. He could operate the accelerator and the brake with his left foot if he had to. It depressed her that she had almost as much contempt for a man who drove a car with an automatic transmission as she did for a man who hit women.
God, look at me. I'm my father's child, Ruth thought.